MENA Watch, der unabhängige Nahost-Think-Tank.
Today my guest is Dr. Einat Wilf. She was born and grew up in Israel. She was an intelligence officer in the Israel Defense Forces, a foreign policy advisor to Deputy Prime Minister Shimon Peres, and a strategic advisor at McKinsey & Company. She holds a BA from Harvard, an MBA from INSEAD in France, and a PhD in political science from the University of Cambridge. She was a Goldman visiting professor at Georgetown University. From 2010 to 2013, she was a member of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, during which time she served as chair of the Education Committee and a member of the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee. Dr. Wilf is the author of 7 books that address key issues in Israeli society. Together with your co-author Adi Schwartz, you wrote the book The War of Return. The German title is Der Kampf Rückkehr, published by Hendrich & Hendrich. There you explain one of the biggest problems of a two-state solution, the so-called Palestinian right of return. Is the Arabs' flee or their expulsion from the newly founded Israel in 1948 the reason? Was there an Israeli plan behind it? That's Arab sources are saying that. Please explain.
Certainly. So thank you for having me.
Very welcome.
Maybe a bit of background as to why I even decided to address this issue. I grew up in the Israeli peace camp with the belief that the only thing that stands between us and peace is a Palestinian state. I voted for every Israeli prime minister that promoted it. I supported every Israeli effort to do it. And with many Israelis of the peace camp, I watched how Palestinians again and again, in 2000 it was Arafat and Ehud Barak, in 2008 it was Abu Mazen and Olmert, the disengagement from Gaza. I saw again and again that Palestinians, when given the choice to have their own state, they don't take it. They don't pursue it. And I began to wonder what's going on. And in meeting with Palestinians and doing research, I realized that they were serious when they told us that they are deeply committed to the fact that there will be no Jewish state. And the main idea through which it was manifested is the claim that millions of them have a right. I'll explain why they don't, but they believe they do. They have a right to settle inside Israel, not in the West Bank and Gaza. Millions of them already live there, against Israeli sovereign will, thereby essentially turning the state of Israel into a Jewish minority state. So when I began to realize that Palestinians are very serious about this, when Israelis were negotiating for peace, they assumed this was a bargaining chip, that Palestinians cannot be serious about this demand because it's the one thing that will end Israel's existence as a sovereign Jewish state. So, you know, the whole idea of a two-state solution was that one of the two is the Jewish state. So it made no sense that they really take it so seriously. So I began to explore what was going on. And like you, I asked the question, okay, was there something in the creation of Palestinian Arab refugees during the War of Israel's Independence in 1948 that was really unique? The short answer is no, and I'll explain. First, the 20th century. The 20th century could be simply described as the political transition from empires to states. We begin the 20th century when much of the world is divided between empires. We end the 20th century when much of the world is divided between states. When they're lucky, they're nation states. They have a certain coherent at least majority, that shares a language, a connection to a land, maybe a shared background, religion, ethnicity. When they're unlucky, some empires drew some lines, threw some people together, and basically told them, you're a state. And they typically spent all the years since that moment in civil war and dictatorship and civil war and dictatorship. So this is broadly the 20th century. Now, this transition from empires to states, in as much as it was important for the spread of rights and democracy, it was bloody. It involved two world wars, numerous local wars, civil wars, regional wars. In that process of empires disintegrating, new states being established, new borders being drawn, tens of millions of people became refugees. That was the story. And all of them basically got the following message. It's sad, it's tragic, and you move on, basically. And many of them became refugees during the war, during the process of the disintegration of the empire. But for example, in the book, we bring the story that people will know of the German refugees who became refugees after Germany surrendered. That's actually quite rare. I mean, after Germany signed an unconditional surrender, 14 million ethnic Germans, nobody bothered to look if they're Nazis or not. It was enough that they were ethnic Germans, were placed on trains and basically sent out of what is today Western Poland, the Sudeten. And tens of millions of people became refugees in war. Hindus and Muslims, Ukrainians, Poles, Italians, Bulgarians, Greeks, Turks, Jews, and Arabs. Nothing special. The Ottoman Empire disintegrated. The interim British and French mandates were over. And essentially new states were created. The only difference in this case is that the Arab refugees that were created as a result of the war, and maybe it's important for me to mention that the war was unnecessary. This was a case where it was a completely unnecessary war. There was a proposal by the United Nations to divide the land. And I always bring a quote by Ernst Bevin, the British foreign minister after World War II. He goes to the British Parliament in February of 47 to explain why Britain essentially failed the terms of the mandate that it received unanimously from the League of Nations to help the Jews achieve sovereignty. It didn't fail the Arabs. It created Iraq and Jordan, and France helped create Syria and Lebanon, but the Jews didn't get a state. So he needs to explain why. This is why the vote goes to the UN, because the UN continues the League of Nations. Britain essentially throws back the mandate. They said we failed. So he needs to explain the failure. And he says, look, His Majesty's government is thus faced with an irreconcilable conflict. He calls it irreconcilable. Now, this is February 47. There's no settlements. There's no occupation. There are no Arab refugees yet. There's no Nakba. There's no State of Israel. There's no Bibi. So I love this because, you know, these are all the things that we are told are the reasons for the conflict. And they don't exist yet. So you have no excuses. And he says the conflict is irreconcilable. And he goes on to explain. And this is because he talked to the side. He says, look, in the land there are Jews and Arabs. Each one of them has a top priority. He says, for the Jews, the top priority is to establish a sovereign Jewish state. Great. The Jews want to exercise the universal principle of self-determination. That's the principle of the 20th century. Instead of empires, self-determination for peoples. Great. The Jews want to exercise that principle of self-determination in their ancestral homeland. The Arabs, he says, and these are not any Arabs. These are Arabs that will one day take the name Palestine to be known as Palestinians. He says the Arabs, their top priority, listen to this, is to resist to the last the establishment of Jewish sovereignty in any part of the land. So this is why the conflict is irreconcilable. He's basically saying the Jews want a state and the Arabs want the Jews not to have a state. You can't really figure that one. Regardless, the United Nations says, okay, still the best solution is partition. Fine. So there was going to be a Jewish state and an Arab state. It's really important that the Arabs could have actually just said yes. You know, a lot of people say, what option do they have? I'm like, they could have said yes. Because especially if you look at the map, the areas allocated to the Jewish state, they're the areas that the Jews reclaimed from malaria plus desert. It's little pieces of land. It's half of what they were promised by the League of Nations. And the Jews still go out to the streets and dance hora. Because as far as the Jews are concerned, it meets their top priority of a state. And the Arabs go to war, which is an entirely unnecessary war because the purpose of that war is not to ensure Arab independence in the land. They could have had that. The purpose of the war is to prevent Jewish independence in any part of the land. So it's an unnecessary war. There could have been two states, one Jewish, one Arab, living in peace, side by side, celebrating 76 years of peace. But no, they went to war for the declared goal. It's not that they hid the goal. The declared goal that the Jews will not be independent. In that, they failed. The Jews were able to rebuff the initial Arab onslaught, the Arab militias, and then...
How many states have been involved?
Between 5 and 7, depends how you count, but several Arab armies, as soon as the British are gone, Israel declares independence, several Arab armies essentially descend to try to prevent the establishment of a Jewish state. So this is a war that lasts about a year and a half. In that war, it's a brutal war. It's a village-to-village war. Certainly from the Jewish perspective, it's an existential war. Again, the Arabs make it clear. You know, we're going to prevent you having independence. They also make it clear what they'll do to the Jews once they don't have independence. So and in the course of that war, hundreds of thousands of people become refugees. Normal. This is important to emphasize. And this is in the course of war. The majority of the Arabs who become refugees are as a result of fleeing. They don't want to be there when there's war. In the beginning, it's the wealthy, it's the educated, it's the people who have homes in Beirut and Alexandria. So essentially all the middle and upper class of the Arabs leave in the beginning. That had a dramatic, actually negative effect on the Arab side. And then ultimately the locals, they flee as the war comes closer. As the war becomes more brutal and extended, especially as the Arab armies prepare to invade, there are also expulsions. There was no premeditated plan. Sometimes the Arabs like to say Zionism from the beginning, it was planned to have expulsions. Absolutely not. You can read all the material. You could blame the early Zionists perhaps for being naive. They thought there could be coexistence. They thought there could be peace. But there was no planned expulsions. It was all in the course of war and only when meeting with resistance. Hmm. When you had Arab villages that didn't resist, for example, that didn't fight, they stayed. This is why 20%, even more, of Israel's population is Arab. It's important to mention that in the areas that ultimately the Jordan occupied in the West Bank and Egypt and the Gaza Strip, no Jews were left. There were clear expulsions of the Jews. This is including from ancient areas like the old city, like the Jewish quarter of the old city. So all this is war. It's brutal. People flee, people are expelled, but it's not unique. There's nothing special in terms of brutality, in terms of numbers, in the creation of the Arab refugees, certainly when you compare it to anything that happens in the world at that time.
So how come that this extended to refugee camps that are existing till now? It's really a vicious thing to keep people in camps 75 years. There is different areas where they are. Mm-hmm. They are in Lebanon, and they are in Iraq, in Egypt, and it's different living situations with all these camps. But first of all, I want to know, how is a refugee defined? Mm-hmm. Because this is probably different from what the Palestinians are. Mm-hmm. And second, I would like to know, what is their situation now, and how can they go on as a refugee?
Okay.
Syria.
Syria too.
Yes.
So we end the war. Mm-hmm. It's important, by the way, to mention that none of Israel's Arab neighbors are willing to make peace with it at the end of the war. They only sign ceasefire agreements, mm-hmm. armistice agreements. Mm-hmm. The first of many, right? We see this pattern. The Arabs basically say, fine, we didn't succeed now in destroying the Jewish state. We're not making peace. We'll wait. We'll wait for the next opportunity. For now, it's a ceasefire. It's a pattern. Okay, there are Arab refugees. Like I said, the tens of millions of refugees around the world at the same time get settled. And they get settled either in the places where they fled or in new places. But they don't go to the places where they fled from. Certainly not if the new country doesn't want it. Certainly not if they belong to the minority that was at war. So there's no such thing as a right of return. The message...
Also, there have been Jews expelled
yes.
at the same time from
exactly.
Arab countries all over.
So exactly.
It's nearly the same amount of people, right?
And I will say it's even worse, because when the Arab countries, during the two decades between the 40s and the 60s, ultimately lead to the complete ethnic cleansing of Jews from Morocco to Afghanistan. You're talking about a million Jews. These are from communities who predated the Arab and Islamic conquest. Some of them, like in Iraq, go back to the Babylonian exile. Gone, sometimes in a matter of weeks, sometimes in a matter of years. They were not at war. They were some of the most loyal, productive members of those societies. The fact that the Arabs still chose to push them out and to expel them, first of all, shows that this whole notion of Jews can live as a minority in Arab lands in harmony, it's true only as long as Jews know their place, meaning as inferior, as subservient. The moment that Jews dared kind of imagine themselves equal and confident, they had to be thrown out. It also erases any notion that they have nothing against Jews, just Zionists, because the way that the Arabs threw out the Jews is by saying that they're against Zionism, right? The laws in Iraq and Egypt were against Zionism, but then they blamed the Jews for being Zionists and they threw them out. And because that's how it always works. And of course, also they strengthened Israel, because the only difference between what Europe did to the Jews in the 30s and 40s and what the Arab world did in the 50s is the existence of the State of Israel. If there was a State of Israel, as there should have been in the 1930s, and the only reason it didn't exist in the 1930s is because of Arab violence and British betrayal, then maybe the genocide in Europe would only have been an ethnic cleansing, right? Because there was a moment when still Jews could get out of Europe. And there was one country that wanted them. It was just not allowed to exist because of Arab violence and British betrayal. So the only difference is that in the 50s, there's a State of Israel. So when the Arab countries expel their Jews, the State of Israel is there to absorb them. Going back to the Arab refugees from the war, the message, as I said, throughout the 20th century to refugees is that it's tough, it's tragic, and you move on. The only group that didn't get the memo is the Arab refugees. What was their story? They were supposed to be settled. A temporary mechanism was created for them in order to settle them. The temporary mechanism was ultimately called UNRWA. I'll say a few words about it. But before, in order to understand what UNRWA was supposed to do, it's great to look at another case, which was called UNCRA. The K is for Korea. At the same time, there's also a very difficult war in Korea. There are 3.1 million refugees in Korea. It's more than four times the number of the Arab refugees from the war. The numbers are agreed to be around 700,000 Arab refugees. So in Korea, you have more than four times the number. UNCRA is created for them. It settles all of them without return. Nobody returns home in about 4 years with a third of UNRWA's budget, and it closes. That's it. This is why it was a temporary mechanism, because it was understood that once you close it, it's over. And look at South Korea today. It could have been the Arab world. And South Korea was more devastated in the 50s than the Arab world. It could have been them, because they got the memo that you move on. You move on, you build, you don't kind of sit and demand to go back.
Was the people ruling those camps that they have temporarily erected also South Korean people, or who did that?
Because, who managed it yes. at the time? No, yes. It was mostly external people.
External, because that's the difference.
Exactly. No, but in the beginning, UNRWA was the same. Oh. Why was it even a temporary mechanism? Because most of the refugee problem at this moment is in Europe. So the greatest focus is on Europe. And for other conflicts, the idea is that you create a temporary mechanism, it settles everyone, and it closes down. So a temporary mechanism for 18 months, a year and a half. Everybody thought that a year and a half should be plenty. A year and a half was established to settle the Arab refugees from the war. Now, at this point, they use an ad hoc definition. People who lived in the land between 46 and 48 and lost their livelihood. It's important to say that this was an operational ad hoc definition. It has nothing to do with the actual definition of refugees in the Refugee Convention. Someone who is individually persecuted cannot go home as a result of danger. It was an ad hoc definition. The reason that it's only 2 years of living in the land is that there was plenty of Arab immigration under the British mandate into the area that became ultimately the State of Israel. Many seasonal workers, so for example, from Lebanon, from Syria, there were a lot of seasonal workers that came to work in agriculture. So it's a very bizarre definition that clearly already in the beginning inflated the number of those who were called refugees. But anyway, they were all supposed to be settled in a year and a half. But we go back to the original goal. The original goal was no Jewish state. So the Arab refugees, after the war, as I said, it ceased fires, they say, okay, we failed to achieve the goal now. We're not done. We'll wait. So they understand that if they're going to settle, this is going to be the Jewish state gets to live, and that's unacceptable. So it's actually the Arab refugees themselves that refused to settle. Initially, the organization, the mechanism for their settlement was staffed by foreigners, mostly people from the US, from Britain, with a lot of good intentions to create jobs and great projects and invest in the Middle East. Those are people that worked on the big projects of the New Deal. But the Arab refugees refused to settle because they know it means that the Jewish state gets to live if they settle. So they burned down the offices and they attacked the staff, still a foreign staff, ensuring that absolutely no one gets settled. Now remember, at the same time that this happens, there's a success story in Korea. So everybody knows that this is a failure. There wasn't any kind of illusion that the effort to settle Arab refugees was failing. But the Arabs already, they want the money that comes from the West. The West wants to give a lot of money to settle the refugees, even for Arab countries. So they basically begin a kind of back and forth with the West on this mechanism. So first they ensure that nobody gets settled. Then they ensure that it has the letters UN in it. Initially, it was going to be called REWA, R-E-W-A. But already then, the Arabs understood, these are both the Arab refugees and the Arab countries, understand that the letters UN have power. And they want it to be called UNRWA. And this is something that has meaning to the present. First of all, the letters are so powerful that when people hear UNRWA, they actually think that it's a UN foreign organization. They don't understand that it's almost all hijacked today by Palestinians, the workers, that everybody's Palestinian. It's not some Norwegians and Swedes who came to help. This is how powerful the letters UN are. And the other thing, it was a message from the Arab world that they're not responsible. They went to war, an unnecessary war. As I said, they could have had their own state, nobody displaced, living in peace. But they chose to go to war because it was more important for them that the Jews not have independence. And when they failed to achieve their goal in the war, their message is, we're not responsible that the outcome of the war is hundreds of thousands of refugees. That's not our responsibility. That's the world. That's the UN. And you can see it that it's to today. A few months after October 7th, a senior Hamas official, Abu Marzouk, was asked in an interview, why don't you let the people of Gaza use the tunnels for their protection? And he laughed and he was like, no. The people of Gaza, the tunnels are for us. The people of Gaza, they're the responsibility of the UN, which they mean UNRWA. So this is a foundational part in the Arab thinking about their role. They're not responsible. There's never cause and effect. There's never consequences for actions. There's never like you went to a stupid, unnecessary war. Those are the consequences. Everyone else in the world understands that. No. So they insisted that it be called UNRWA. They created a loophole. That's really important. At the same time that UNRWA is existing for those temporary year and a half, the world creates the actual organization of the UN to implement the Refugee Convention, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Now, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees implements the Refugee Convention. The Refugee Convention does not prioritize return. The Refugee Convention wants you to stop being a refugee. However, so if you can go home, that's great. But if not, UNHCR doesn't sit and say, no, we're going to sit here and there's going to be refugee neighborhoods where people are going to be refugees for five generations and we're going to demand return. That's not what they do. They say, look, you can't go home. And it doesn't matter why, who started it. It doesn't matter. You can't go home. Let's find you another solution. Maybe you can stay here. Maybe it can be, I don't know, Canada. But that's it. And then as soon as that person is settled, they take them off the list, and that's considered a success. So the Arabs, again, playing the long game, understood that if the Arab refugees would be subjected to the international standards of the Refugee Convention, within a few years, there will be no Arab refugees because they will be individually settled. So they create a loophole. And the loophole reads like this: that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees will take care of all refugees in the world, except those that have an agency. Fine. And then what they need to make sure is that UNRWA never closes. Because the loophole that allows them basically to avoid any international standards depends on UNRWA never closing. And just so we understand how absurd it is, today, UNRWA, I think, lifts about 6.1 million refugees in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, West Bank, and Gaza. Those are the five areas of operations. The Palestinians, by the way, count even more. They say 9, 10 million, because as far as they're concerned, you could have Swedish citizenship. You might be born in Germany. They don't care. You're still a refugee, a Palestine refugee. Okay, but let's go with the official UNRWA numbers. Just so you understand how absurd it is. First of all, the vast majority by now are not the people who were originally in the war. They are the descendants.
How come they get that through?
Because they have the loophole. And the loophole basically allows them to avoid international standards. So they just do whatever they want. It's a closed, it's basically closed off from the international system. They do whatever they want. So they're not subject to international standards. I want to show what would have happened if there were international standards. First, in Jordan and in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, they're still where they are. They're already settled. They're under the Palestinian Authority. They're in Gaza. There's nowhere that they need to go to settle. So they're not refugees. Certainly second, third, fourth, you're talking about 30-year-old lawyers living in Ramallah who are registered as refugees. Middle class, working as lawyers. They were born in Ramallah under the Palestinian Authority. They're not refugees. So that's already 40%.
Yes. Yeah, but the question is, they are financed still by the United Nations. So this is the reason, probably what I think, mm-hmm. that they are still claiming that they are refugees in the third and the fourth generation already.
There's no doubt that the fact that UNRWA registers them is their claim. Mm. But the reason that UNRWA registers them is because they hijacked UNRWA once they ensured that it's not subject to international standards, began the process of making UNRWA basically a Palestinian organization that serves the Palestinian goal of no Jewish state. So 40% are not refugees. They're in the West Bank and Gaza. Another 40% are Jordanian citizens. Jordan, to its credit, naturalized them. It also naturalized the ones in the West Bank, but then it took away their citizenship. But it naturalized. They are Jordanian citizens. They were born in Jordan. They traveled the world with a Jordanian passport. They occupy all levels in Jordanian society, in business, in government, in parliament. They are not refugees. Nowhere in the world are you a citizen of a country and they're born a citizen. I mean, they're not refugees. Okay. Then you're left, that's another 40%. So already 80%, completely bogus number. Then the other 20% are divided between Syria and Lebanon. We know from data in the last few years that the vast majority of them left. Now, the original ones would really be refugees. They fled across a border. Syria and Lebanon denied them citizenship. And the original ones would be refugees. Their descendants are mostly what you call stateless. And think of it, these are Arabs born in Lebanon, born in Syria, only denied citizenship in order to keep the conflict against Israel alive. But we know that many of them left, the majority. Many of them are actually in Germany. They have German citizenship. And yet they are still registered as refugees because UNRWA, unlike the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, never takes anyone off the lists. They don't say, oh, wonderful, you have a Jordanian citizenship, you have a German citizenship, excellent, I'm taking you off the list. No, because the whole idea is to keep the Palestinians as this idea of endless perpetual refugees until one thing happens, which is this notion of return. Now, it's important to say that because sometimes Western politicians will say, the reason they are still refugees is because there's no political solution. We just need to fund them until there's a political solution. And maybe just before that, a word on the funding, because UNRWA is still, after 75 years, a temporary organization that gets renewed. It's not part of the UN budget. It basically has Western countries funding it every time they need to again get money, because it's still temporary. It's not like a UN organ. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees is the UN organ. UNRWA is still temporary. So sometimes people say, well, when there is a political solution, this will be over. But again, it's exactly the opposite. The purpose of UNRWA is to prevent any political solution, which is not the destruction of the Jewish state. That's important. Maybe if you can show later, I'll send it to you. at the entrance to a neighborhood near Beit Lechem, under the Palestinian Authority. It's called a refugee camp, but it's not. It's a neighborhood. No one there is a refugee. It's not a camp. It's a regular neighborhood. But in the entrance to that so-called refugee camp, there's a big sign that says, UNRWA services are our right. Notice the language, until return. They're basically saying, you, the world, will pay for our services. And this is not aid. This is normal services, education, healthcare, the services of a normal functioning country. You, the West, basically owe us. You'll pay for it. Not until we have a state, not until, you know, Israel is out of the West Bank, until return. And here I want to say something about return and the kind of the Palestinian Arab mindset. Because for many years, people imagined return as some innocent nostalgia for a great grandmother's home that was lost. But look at the Arab texts going to the 50s, the 60s. The way they describe return is violent, is bloody. We will take their hearts out of their bodies, their fingernails from their hands. I mean, they describe return as the exercise of the triumph over the Jewish state, over the Jewish body. Return was basically the way of saying the war against the Jewish state will not be over until we win. And we win, from the Arab perspective, means no Jewish state. And you only have to look at their texts. After October 7th, I've been telling people, October 7th is the minute-by-minute realization of the Palestinian vision of return. This is why there was so much exhilaration among Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, around the world, and their collaborators, not because they were escaping some prison. We know, you know, now they tell us, oh, Gaza was so wonderful. They would have gone on the border with Egypt. No. And you see it also in the videos and what they say. We're returning. This is the reason you had so much exhilaration on October 7th is that in their world, Hamas was finally realizing their dream for the last 75 years to finally bring an end to the Jewish state and exercise return. So that's the story here. And this is, of course, why I'm personally so invested in working on it and highlighting it, because people actually think that UNRWA is this like nice, helpful organization, whereas it's the arsonist. They want everyone to think they're the firefighters, right? They go, they turn. No, they're the arsonists. They're the ones that constantly ensure that the war never ends. I mean, UNRWA is at the original sin of having prevented the Arabs, indulging them, from getting the memo that said, tough, tragic, and move on.
Still, there is something very, very, I cannot find an English word, but funny about it. The UNRWA gets per person from whoever 206 euro or dollar. It's euros per head. And the UNHCR, they have 46 euro per person. So this is a really pervert system that you are explaining here, because all these people who give funding don't ask what it is for. They are just doing that as, for example, Germany, first of all, they stopped for a while because they saw that there is something going wrong. And then all of a sudden they came back to it. There is something irrational about all this happening, because if you have money and you want to spend it, we have a crisis here, economy-wise. But still giving this money to an organization that has really a critical background. And now I want to know, what is your vision of a solution without UNRWA? Because this was discussed lately.
So over the years, a lot of people kept on asking me, if there's no UNRWA, What will replace it? So first of all, the answer is very simple everywhere. In Jordan, it's the Jordanian government. By the way, most of the people who are registered as refugees in Jordan don't even consume the UNRWA services. It's just more about the political statement that they are Palestine refugees.
This model, Hadid, in Los Angeles, she's a refugee. Her father, millionaire, billionaire, he's a refugee.
So he's actually, yes, he's still, she's born in America. But yeah, the idea, for them, it's a political statement. Mm-hmm. So in Jordan, Jordan provides the services. Mm-hmm. In the West Bank, it's the Palestinian Authority. In Syria and Lebanon, as I said, we know most of them left. If you're actually looking for a solution rather than return and the destruction of the Jewish state, then it's very simple. You make sure how many Palestinians still live in Syria and Lebanon. You bring in the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. The numbers are probably no more together in Syria and Lebanon of 200,000-300,000. And you give them 5 years to settle all of them, either in Syria and Lebanon or other countries, and that's it. But according to international standards, and you take them off the list, they're no longer refugees. And then people over the years would tell me, but Gaza? What about Gaza? Do you want Hamas to run the schools? And I would say, yes. And that made me sound crazy. But now I can explain why was absolutely true. Because let's understand for a moment, what does it mean if there's no UNRWA? Let's understand the practicalities. If you understand that it's not Norwegians, it's Swedes, it's all Palestinians. The teachers, the administrators, everyone, the managers, they are Gazans born and bred, with the vision, of course, of returning from the river to the sea. But they're the people there. So what does it mean for UNRWA not to exist? No one goes home. It's not that the lovely Norwegian teacher goes back home, right? Everyone stays. These are people that were born and raised in Gaza. So the only question is, who pays their salaries? That's it. That's the only thing. So I want to introduce a radical, innovative, and original idea for paying teachers' salaries. It goes like this. You run an economy, which we know that Hamas did. You collect taxes, which we know that Hamas did on the very, very fruitful trade they had with Egypt above and below ground. And then you use those taxes to pay teacher salaries. Now, I know it's original, it's radical. And to explain for a moment, what would it have meant if the world basically told the people of Gaza, that's it, you're on your own, you're big kids, run this place, pay teacher salaries. If Hamas had to pay teacher salaries, maybe they would have had fewer hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars over several years to build the hundreds of kilometers of tunnels to get weapons. We even know recently that UNRWA in Gaza demanded that the pay in teachers be in cash. Mm-hmm. So you had trucks of cash going in. Why? Because cash, dollar, foreign cash, was necessary in order to bribe the Egyptians and to bring in the weapons. That's how the economy worked. So imagine that Hamas actually had to pay the teachers. They would have had fewer billions of dollars over several years to build tunnels. Imagine they would have had to spend their time arguing with teacher unions and angry parents. Maybe they would have had less time to plan October 7th. So when people tell me what will replace UNRWA, I say two words, Palestinian responsibility. The idea that they will finally be held responsible. There's a term in psychology that is called learned helplessness. It's when you are constantly basically taught to be helpless. Now, the thing is this, the Palestinians are not really helpless. We saw it on October 7th. I think we can all agree that October 7th required years and massive economic and financial investment in infrastructure. It required fairly sophisticated economic and financial planning. It required strategy, discipline, vision. It's a perverse vision, but it was vision. These are not an incapable people. These are just people who have for decades used all their capabilities for the single goal of no Jewish state. It's actually a tragedy. And in that tragedy, so many Western countries are complicit. And you said something about it being irrational. And I want to share with you a kind of darker thought that I began to have after October 7th. Because I arrived at the UNRWA issue from a very rational perspective. I was like, I support two states, Jewish state here, our Palestinian state here. So then I began to see this whole UNRWA thing, and I saw that the Palestinians were serious, and I was like, but it doesn't make sense that the West funds it, because if the West wants peace based on a two-state solution, then why are they funding the one organization that ensures that it will never happen, because it's an organization that sustains generation after generation the idea from the river to the sea of return? So I invested a lot of time in writing a book and getting it translated and essays and speeches. And Adi and I would repeatedly come to European capitals. I genuinely believed that if people would see the data, the history, and I will say something about our book, you know, even if people oppose our recommendations, which is to close down UNRWA, there's no right of return, no one has ever challenged the book and the research on the facts. So I thought, okay, people will see the facts. They will change their policy. And when I see the fanatical support that some European countries and diplomats and officials have for UNRWA, I began to wonder, could it be that it's not that they don't understand what the money goes for, that they don't know why they're funding UNRWA? Could it be that they actually know? And that somewhere in the deep recesses of Western European civilization, they're kind of using UNRWA to outsource their ambivalence about the existence of a Jewish state.
And they get the invoice now with all these groups all over the world that are fanatic and aggressive and really violent. So maybe this will show them that they have to have another view on the conflict.
Yes.
Let me ask you, though, you have five concepts about Israel. Can you please tell us what is, and it is including to the analysis or the definition of Zionism, isn't it?
Okay. Yes. It's been a while since I gave that talk, but... and if people want it, they can find it on the internet. But I think I remember it was the idea of Israel's an idea, that Israel is first and foremost based on the idea of Zionism, that is its source of power, the idea that the Jewish people as a people and a nation have the equal right to self-determination in the one land in which they were ever a people and a nation, in the land of Israel. So I talk about the power of ideas, of vision, of imagination in Israel's history, about the fact that we're a country of movement and immigrants, that on the one hand, people came here because they're Jewish, but because the Jewish exile has been so long, many of them bring in their culture so that Israel has this remarkable cultural mix. Another one is one where I talk about Israel's a Jewish state and what that really means, what being Jewish is, and really the ongoing debate on interpretation of Israel's a Jewish state. Then I talk about Israel and its relation to both its Arab minority and the Arab neighbors, and really what is at the core of the conflict. And at the end of the day, there's just no escaping that foundational to the entire conflict has been, remains, a certain Arab, even Islamic, inability to accept the Jews as sovereign, as equals in their historic homeland. And that much of what animates the conflict, with a lot of unfortunate Western collaboration and indulgence and support, is not anything negotiable. Not okay, no settlements, get out of the West Bank and all that. It's a total demand. Abba Ibn, our legendary ambassador, mm-hmm. called it policide. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the non-allowing of the Jews mm-hmm. to be masters of their fate, because they could not be allowed to do that one thing.
I'm smiling because I just recommended the book that he wrote, This Is My People.
Yes.
I love this book. It's really good to read, and I'm going to write a little note for the people from Mena Watch to buy this book. It's very old. Mm-hmm. I don't know when he wrote it. It's very long time ago, but it's still fresh.
Exactly. And he's a wonderful writer.
I mean, besides your book, I have already waited for the German translation. Mm-hmm. And so this is very important for people to read it. Let's talk about the Israeli politics. Sometimes here there are very myths and things that people don't really understand. Is there some term that you can compare to German right and left wing politics, or do you have a different kind of differences between the parties? System in Israel is one of the biggest problems, I guess. 3% is not enough for each party. We have 5%, and still you have too many parties.
Yeah. I think we need to take the electoral threshold down.
down? Smaller. But then you have coalitions like the two people from the right-wing party using their power.
But it's actually the opposite. If you look historically, when the electoral system was lower, it was more stable because you had some extreme voices, but they tended to be very small parties. They didn't tend to be part of bigger parties. And you had actually more room to maneuver. Mm-hmm. So, and I wrote a book about the Israeli electoral system before they raised the threshold, and I warned against raising the threshold. And a lot of our current political crisis actually comes from raising the threshold.
Okay.
And not, it was better when it was lower, and I hope they'll bring it down. Obviously, in Israel, the issues that define our political battles fundamentally have always been about the questions of security, the conflict, what our enemies want. I would say that in recent years, unfortunately, the battle has focused too much on the personality of Netanyahu, to the point that there is not enough discourse about policy and too much about for and against a particular personality. Other issues tend to be religion and state, secularism. But October 7th, even if not immediately, will ultimately deeply transform Israeli politics. Because I think for a very long time, we lived under a lie that our enemies are deterred, that Israel is strong. You know, people like to pretend now that October 7th was not a big deal. We were this close. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the program, Sinwar had a clear program. There will be the invasion from Gaza. It will be supported by the invasion from Lebanon, which we know would have been a multiple of the damage of the invasion of Gaza. It will inspire the Arabs of the West Bank and the Arabs who are Israel citizens, to also attack Jews. Maybe Iran would have then sent its rockets. Not clear that Israel would have survived that. So, you know, people like to pretend that it was just like some... No, it was very much a premeditated, long-planned attack that could have succeeded from their perspective. So Israelis now, I think, have a deeper visceral sense of the threat. This is something that even when we had political disagreements, which we always did, the Jews have always had political disagreements, even when we had political disagreements during the early decades of Israel, it was in the context that everyone understood that our enemies were serious. You know, our first leaders came from the pogroms. They experienced the Arab massacres in the 20s and the 30s, the violence. So they knew that we had total enemies that were not looking for something negotiable, that their goal was to destroy, to prevent, and then to undo the existence of a Jewish state. And I think that understanding is coming back. And I think it will recreate our politics around a more centrist understanding and commitment to Israel's defense.
I mean, the belief that the security system will help and make things easier has failed.
Yes.
And I hope that this will not happen again. I think that they work on that. And the first thing that came to my mind was terrible what happens to these people that are captured.
Yes.
And the second thought was that now the Arabs think that Israel is weak. Mm-hmm. You should never deconstruct their image of Israel being on top of everybody. Mm-hmm. But I have another question. We have in Germany a very big theme, mm-hmm. subject about the settlements,
yes.
and the West Bank. And now the aggressive settlers are helping, mm-hmm. this rumor. It's not a rumor. They are doing things that are illegal and bad. But first of all, I don't read anywhere how it started. It's like they fall from the sky and started attacking Arabs. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this is the way it happened. So, mm-hmm. I wished you could tell us how this started, mm-hmm. and how it will end. Is there a possibility that this will, mm-hmm. stop?
So for that, I have to say a few words about settlements. Generally, not a project that I support. I think it's been Israel's most wasteful one. And also, I think the main problem has been actually that the settlements in the West Bank and at the time in Gaza took place without annexation. Because in Jerusalem, for example, I think it was terrible for Jerusalem, but Israel annexed a big territory after 67 and created the bigger city of Jerusalem, and it built neighborhoods. Now, it's true that officially people in the world consider even those settlements, but no one is there is behaving violently because it's under the rule of Israel. It's normal. So people who live there just lead normal lives. What happens in the West Bank is that it's a kind of no man's land. Because what happens? On the one hand, there are Jews who settle there are saying, okay, you know, Israel has a claim to the land. It's true. Arabs repeatedly rejected partition, so the claim to the land that goes back to the 1920s remains. Israel has a legitimate legal claim to the land. We're going to settle. And every time that the Arabs, the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza, could have had a state in the West Bank and Gaza, we go back to the beginning. If it meant living next to a Jewish state, they didn't want it. So Israel is stuck, essentially. I think one of the deepest senses in Israel politically is that when it comes to the Arabs and especially the Palestinians, we're stuck because we tried everything. We tried dividing the land. We said repeatedly yes. We offered repeatedly a Palestinian state. Again and again and again, they walk away. They follow it up with violence. There's no debate even within Palestinian society saying we should take this deal, we shouldn't. Nothing. It's clear that they don't want it. We tried to disengage from Gaza, to say, you know what? If the Palestinians can't agree with us to have a Palestinian state, we'll just get out. We'll force them to be independent. That was the idea of the disengagement from Gaza. Now we see what happened in Gaza. Rather than build Gaza, you know, Gaza sits on a beautiful strip of land, gorgeous beaches. It's the crossroads of two ancient trade routes. With a mentality that doesn't seek to destroy the Jewish state, they could have made it into one of the most beautiful places in the world. But no, it was more important for them to destroy the Jewish state. So Israelis are saying, we're stuck. What are we going to do? So in the West Bank, we didn't annex, but there's also no Palestinian state, and it's a web of agreements, the Oslo Accords from the 90s and all that. And as a result, in a no man's land, you develop a kind of no man's behavior.
Authority.
So officially the military is there, but it's not really the state of Israel. And as a result, you have essentially people there who are behaving in a lawless manner. And what you have in the West Bank is almost a return to kind of biblical, you know, fighting times between peasants and, you know, the sheep, the people who shepherds, and like, it's at that level. But what I see is that essentially the problem is that the area itself is not settled. It's neither here nor there. So as a result, there tends to be a lawless culture that develops there. But it's important to say, none of this has any bearing on the Palestinian vision of no Jewish state. You know, I have colleagues on the left who say, okay, we understand that the Palestinians have this vision of no Jewish state, of return, but still, we shouldn't build settlements or we should remove them so that they have a horizon, so that they have hope. That's my colleagues on the left. Then I have colleagues on the right who say, no, we need to build so that they know that we're never going anywhere and that they understand that we can't be pushed out. That's my colleagues on the right. And I tell them, look, I hate to break it to you, on the left and on the right, because by now we have empirical proof over decades. We've built settlements, we've removed settlements. We occupied land, we disengaged from land. We have a left-wing government, we have a right-wing government. The impact of all of those on the Palestinian vision of no Jewish state is zero. The only thing that ever begins to move the needle is when they're isolated. When they, rather than being supported, they begin to hear the message of no. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, when the Arab world was against them, when they supported Saddam Hussein, they began to move. And ultimately we wasted that opportunity. But those are the things that move the needle. Not whether Israel builds or removes settlements, not whether Israel occupies land or gets out of it, not whether it has a right-wing government or a left-wing government. Those are not the things that move the needle.
Okay. So, last question. Mm-hmm. How do you expect Trump's presidency have an impact on Israel? Is it better than Biden's presidency?
That's certainly the hope. Look, we look back. One of the greatest difficulties I had in the years 2016 to 2020 during the first Trump presidency is that people were so crazy discussing him that you couldn't have a rational discussion about policy. But the policies he had in our region were everything that needed to be done. He defunded UNRWA. He closed the PLO offices. He recognized the Golan Heights. He recognized Jerusalem. He basically sent the message through his policies of enough is enough. And as I said, this is what moves the needle. Mm-hmm. Basically, the Palestinians were denied, I think, the benefit of someone telling them in 1949, like we said, it's over. Given that your goal in the war was to prevent the existence of a Jewish state, you lost. And you have to move on from this loss. I've written a lot recently about the importance of clear victory and clear defeat in wars. That in order to move forward, it's important sometimes to know that you've lost, you draw a line, and then you move forward. But the Palestinians, and this is what I talked about, the original sin of UNRWA, were always told, no, you didn't lose. Your victory is still waiting. So keep going. Just keep going. So I think what the Trump policies helped do is essentially convey the message of enough is enough. You lost. Move on. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he ended his term in office last time with 4 peace and normalization agreements and momentum for more. Then the Biden administration did something terrible. They began to undo all those policies. They refunded UNRWA. They basically sent the message to Palestinians, no, no, don't change anything. You're good like you are. You don't need to reckon with your terrible ideology of no Jewish state. Just keep going. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they're ending their term in office with essentially a regional war. So certainly the hope is that with Trump back in office, we see it through some of the nominations, the ones that especially are Israel facing, the UN ambassador, the Israeli ambassador, the Secretary of State. The hope is that this will help convey the message to Palestinians and the Arab world of enough is enough. You can live next to a Jewish state, but not instead of it. So enough with from the river to the sea, enough with the perpetual refugeehood, it's over. And as I said, this is the only thing that has ever moved the needle. So there's certainly a lot of hope that this will finally change the direction after so many decades of the West indulging the idea that the Palestinians can still be victorious over the Jewish state. Maybe finally someone will put a stop to it.
And in Israel, what will go on with the government, and what is Netanyahu's future?
It's tough to say. I always say that no one made any money ever betting against him. I've always said it for years. He's definitely trying to hang on. I think he wants to try to make the most of a Trump presidency. But fundamentally, sooner or later, October 7th will change the politics of Israel. It will transform it, I think, in a very deep way. Wars have a way of doing that.
Yeah. Let's hope that it will be an end to Hamas and Hezbollah's influence in this area. We will have to wait. It takes time.
I'll say even more. It's not just their influence. It's the influence of their ideology. Certainly, I think, I wouldn't be surprised if the Iranian regime will fall during a Trump presidency. But it won't be enough. We need to bring what I've come to call Palestinianism, the ideology of a total rejection of a Jewish state in any part of the land. That has to end. Hamas merely represented it. The ideology has to go.
And do we have any chance of getting a release of the hostages soon?
That is also something that we hope for, that... Again, so far there has been so much indulgence of Hamas, right? From the beginning, everyone allowed them to negotiate. Think for a moment how crazy it is that they invaded a country, butchered people, massacred, kidnapped, and then everyone was like, okay, now negotiate. That's insane. And the fact that Israel was forced to supply the enemy, which means that Hamas remains in power, and they continue to negotiate. More than a year after October 7th, they're still saying, okay. So I hope here too, a Trump presidency will bring them down to basically say, no, you don't get to make demands. You release them or you pay a price. He said that in one of his speeches. And I hope he'll act on it rather than, you know, the Biden administration kept on pressuring Israel, which was so stupid because, again, Israel was willing to compromise. But as for the last few decades, there's always this pattern. The Arabs say death to Israel and everyone likes, okay, thank you. And Israel says, look, we're willing to make some substantial compromises, but we will not commit suicide. And people are like, oh, that's not okay. So the same thing with the hostages. Israel was willing to go above and beyond to release people, to give supplies. But I think someone actually then constantly pressuring Israel should tell the Palestinians, you don't get to make demands. And if you continue to making those demands rather than releasing the hostages, you will pay a price. And I have to say, right now, from the perspective of those who hold the hostages, they don't think they paid a price. They're still in control. So they need to understand that there will be a price to pay and that it will not be constant pressure on Israel.
Einat, thank you so much for being here and giving a very, very interesting view at the situation. And we will hopefully have next time better talk about what is about Hanukkah and about whatever nice things. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns. Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.